Ready for our final case of the day, Judson Atkinson Candies against Latini Hoberger. Mr. Isgett.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning. Percy Isgett from Houston, Texas, appearing on behalf of Judson Atkinson. This case, as Your Honors know, is a case where Judson Atkinson brought suit for a fraudulent transfer, alleging fraudulent transfer on part of the defendants. Judson Atkinson is a judgment creditor of one of the defendants, LMC International, having been awarded a judgment as a result of a defective candy machine sold by LMC International. At the outset, in this summary judgment case, this court's admonition in the Shepard versus Slater Steel case, admonishing trial courts to avoid the temptation to decide which party's version of the facts is more likely true, was not observed. We were faced immediately upon receipt of the court's opinion and order with a finding that there was a summary judgment motion which had not been filed. We were also faced with the award of a judgment in favor of a defaulting defendant. It had been Judson Atkinson's premise in this lawsuit throughout the case that controlling members of the LMC International Corporation had been systematically removing the assets of the LMC Corporation away from its creditors.
Keep your voice up.
I'm sorry.
Don't move the microphone. Do not touch the microphone. Right. Just keep your voice up, please.
Thank you, sir. I've been coming from another climate. I'm having a bit of a respiratory issue this morning. I'll try to do that. It had been Judson Atkinson's premise throughout the context of this case that assets of LMC International were systematically removed in an effort to take them out of the harm's way of the many creditors of both LMC International and its parent corporation, Carroll International Corp. We were also of the opinion and did allege that the primary shareholder of all of the corporations, Mr. Barry J. Carroll individually, had benefited from these transfers, once again to the detriment of the creditors. One of the issues raised in the brief was whether or not a memorandum from which had been disclosed in discovery was indeed privileged. It was in that memorandum that Judson Atkinson's allegations were vindicated. The attorneys had said that LMC International is insolvent.
I think that is your best evidence?
No, Your Honor, it's not. It's simply evidence that
What is your best evidence that particular assets were transferred without reasonably equivalent consideration?
Fine. Be happy to go through that, Your Honor. Categorize the transfers within the various categories of the Uniform Transfer Act, Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. We have evidence that funds, revenues, and loans flowed from LMC International. LMC International had no separate bank account. Those funds were commingled daily with those of Carroll International. And they were used by Carroll International to pay its own bills, to pay its own salaries, and to not pay the creditors of LMC.
Could you address my question? What is your best evidence that particular assets were transferred without reasonably equivalent consideration?
We have transfers to Mr. Barry J. Carroll, from 1999 to 2005, exceeding $1 million. There was no consideration flowing to LMC International. We've listed those in our brief. We referred to them in the record. There are numerous transfers, over 200. From 2001 to 2004, Mr. Carroll was taking $500,000 out of a company with a deficit of over $10 million. Significant transfers were made for those very same funds, all of which are mentioned in the brief, showing transfers to other entities owned and controlled by Barry J. Carroll. Carroll International had no revenue. That's undisputed. It's described in numbers. And then we listed 286 checks, summarized them in exhibits number 10 and 11, showing transfers were made without consideration over this period of time from LMC International to the other defendants. They're described in Exhibits 10 and 11, which was a summary. The individual checks are part of the record, having been filed manually after the judge, the district court had indicated that the summary needed the backup checks. We had attempted to file them. The clerk refused them because they were too voluminous. We entered a summary and yet still entered the backup checks. The checks are in the record. The summary is Exhibits 10 and 11. There was no dispute that the transfers made had been made. What we came to in this case was the defendant's attempt to say that these transfers were nothing more than ordinary course of business. The transfers were there. The issue was there insolvency, and therefore were these transfers fraudulent under the statute? The district court held that we did not prove insolvency, and yet evidence of insolvency ran through the entirety of the record. Insolvency existed with the very simple fact that there was an $11 million loan claimed by one defendant from LMC, and there was never an indication that the assets of LMC indicated anywhere near $11 million. Using statutory definitions of insolvency, it was clear that there was insolvency, and the district court held that there was not insolvency.
What was the evidence of insolvency?
Well, undisputed evidence, Your Honor. Carroll International Corporation claimed in their own pleadings and in their own records that there was an $11 million note owed by LMC to Carroll International. We disputed the validity of the note. We did not dispute the validity of the amount. There was evidence submitted by the defendants, and we adopted it as our own in our summary judgment responses, which showed that LMC International had net deficits in the neighborhood of $7 to $8 million in the years in question, and that Carroll International had net deficits in the neighborhood of $10 to $20 million. That we felt was sufficient evidence of insolvency simply because we used a statutory definition of assets exceeding liabilities and the inability to pay the debts when true. It was undisputed that LMC did not have the ability to pay its debts, evidenced by the fact that it liquidated and did not pay its creditors. And yet the district court held there was no evidence of insolvency. At best,
well, it ended up making an assignment for benefit of creditors, right?
At the end, yes, sir.
And what was the amount of that assignment?
The amount of the assignment was approximately, before administrative cost, was approximately $75,000.
How much?
$75,000. And the administrative costs were in the neighborhood of $40,000, leaving approximately $30,000 for creditors in excess. Of course, with the judgment creditors, we were looking at $4 million in liabilities.
And after that, LMC had no assets.
That is correct. And LMC made that assignment, created the L Liquidation Company, at a time when LMC knew that it was insolvent, and at a time when LMC knew that that transfers had been made to avoid paying the creditors. The memorandum that we've discussed in the privilege issue points out that exact same plan, which was to remove as many assets as possible and then leave little for the creditors. We felt that a fraudulent transfer had occurred, and hence this lawsuit followed. There were fact issues present in the summary judgment case. If the district court does not weigh the evidence and decide the credibility of the witnesses, in this case, the district court did so. We think it's evidenced by the sua sponte judgments. We think it's evidenced by the court's findings and by the court's findings ignoring evidence which was in place at the time and ignoring arguments which were in the summary judgment motion. The permeating atmosphere is shown in the award of reclusive and monetary sanctions which occurred near the end of the case. In that instance, there were documents that were subpoenaed through a miscommunication of counsel. Copies of the subpoenas were not provided to opposing counsel. Immediately upon discovery that the notice had not been given, I offered a stipulation whereby none of the documents subject that had been produced pursuant to the subpoena would be used. And I further pointed out to defense counsel that all of the documents subject to subpoena had been produced in prior discovery by the very same defendants. This was not accepted by the defendants, and they presented the judge with a quite different story.
What was the point of subpoenaing documents that you already had? This seems very strange.
It did seem strange, Your Honor, and the reason it happened was this. Throughout the course of discovery in this case, we were faced with, as documents would be produced, there had been over somewhere in the neighborhood of 20,000 documents produced. Throughout the course of that, there would be gaps in banking records, inexplicable gaps. And as we were approaching the end of the discovery period, we were attempting to fill those gaps. As it turned out, the documents which were ultimately produced by the MB Bank, MB Financial, did not serve to fill those gaps.
In other words, there weren't any gaps.
Well, there were still gaps. There were gaps, but the documents that we thought would fill those gaps, the documents actually produced by the bank, did not fill those gaps. And that's all it was. The district court, in awarding the preclusive sanctions with regard to those documents, makes the finding that the fact that all of these documents had previously been produced is of no value because there's no way the defendants could know which documents they had produced. We found that to be somewhat... It raised an issue in my mind because I had never been in a position in practicing law for many years of having to account to my opponents of what they produced to me. I always take on the fact that they should know what they have and what they have not. The judge then seized upon one incident that he calls questionable behavior, a statement in there that we had not complied with the prior court order regarding discovery, when in fact, as shown by the record in the court at that time, we had complied with all orders and in fact filed notices demonstrating our compliance with the court's order. In short, we felt sanctions did not show any evidence of bad faith and were not justified. With that, unless there's any questions, I'll reserve the rest of the time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Del Nero.
Good morning, Your Honors. John Del Nero on behalf of all of the appellees in this case. May it please the court. This case involves a scenario in which a very simple, uncollectible judgment turned into a secondary lawsuit to try to hold a number of parties that had nothing to do with the underlying transaction liable for that claim. What had happened was that Judson Atkinson obtained a default judgment against a company called LMC. It did not involve or implicate any of the other parties that are involved in this appeal, which include the parent corporation, the shareholder of the parent corporation, or parties that purchased assets from LMC. They were brought in an after-the-fact way to try to collect the judgment. So this is really an extraordinary collection proceeding is the way I would describe it. What has happened here is that Judson has raised three different types of claims in an effort to hold all these various strangers liable for that judgment. They've raised a piercing argument, a fraudulent conveyance argument, and a breach of fiduciary duty argument. Before I address the individual cause of action, it's very important to clear up the most important misconception that is placed in briefs before this court. And that argument is that somehow Judge Castillo weighed evidence improperly or made credibility judgments. And in fact, what was argued even before the court in Mr. Isgut's presentation was that the judge somehow weighed the credibility of witnesses. In reading that 53-page opinion, you will see for every time that they say that the judge weighed credibility or weighed evidence, you will see the following statements from Judge Castillo. There's no evidence in the record. Judson Atkinson is not pointing to any evidence. The fact of the matter is what the judge was doing was not weighing evidence. He was pointing to the fact that the record was devoid of critical elements to prove the case of Judson Atkinson. This is not a matter of swearing contests where you have an affidavit of one party saying X and another affidavit from the opposing party saying that it's not X. There is nothing at all like that in this case. This is simply a matter of sifting through the evidence in a 53-page opinion, point by point by point, and pointing out that there is either a complete failure of evidence or a failure of counsel to point to evidence, and that is why summary judgment was entered in this case. Now, as I said, there were three different issues that were raised. The first is the piercing issue, and what is being raised there is that somehow LMC should disregard its corporate form, that it is not really the true party here. It is the parent corporation, CIC.
On the piercing issue, do you believe there is any significant choice of law problem in the case?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because what we're doing is we're talking about piercing initially the corporate veil of LMC. LMC is an Illinois corporation.
I take it that that depends on LMC's state of incorporation.
That is correct. And that is undisputed to be Illinois. The only other corporation that's involved here is CIC, and that's a Delaware corporation.
With respect to the other choice of law question, well, there's a Uniform Act. One wonders why the district court devoted such a huge chunk of his opinion to choice of law if choice of law doesn't matter. Was this an issue that was debated at length in the district court?
It really was, Your Honor. And
Why did the parties spend time debating an issue whose answer is irrelevant?
Well, it was not irrelevant below, and I'll tell you the reason why. The reason why is that Judson Atkinson had pointed throughout the underlying litigation that Texas had a unique type of law that involved the question of it, and I forgot the label of it, but it was sort of a common enterprise type of theory. They kept trying to push to Judge Castillo that there was a unique law under Texas that allowed courts to aggregate family corporations. And in order to dispose of the issue...
Everybody agrees that it's the law of the state of incorporation that matters, and none of the defendants is incorporated in Texas. Why would anybody care?
Well, the reason why, Your Honor, was because Judson Atkinson was trying to assert that because they originally brought this case in Texas, and Judson Atkinson is a Texas corporation, that they wanted to take the benefit of Texas law, which apparently has some sort of common enterprise type of theory.
On the piercing question.
It's related to the piercing question. It is a parallel type of proceeding, as I understand it, but it is not relevant, and the court found that because we're dealing solely with Illinois, the state of incorporation for LMC, that this whole common enterprise theory was not relevant.
Since it's been raised by my colleague, let's stay on it for a minute and ask, with respect to the fraudulent transfer, is there any, in your view, any significant choice of law issue in the case?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe that there is, because it is a Uniform Act. As Judge Easterbrook pointed out, the statute is the same.
I understand, but there's no significant state deviation in interpretation.
Not that I'm aware of, and certainly not for any issue that is before this court. And if you'd like, I'll address the fraudulent conveyance issue, because it certainly seems to be...
I don't want to throw you off track.
No, it's
track,
okay.
We were on this choice of law and the other issue had been raised, I wanted to just get it out of the way.
But I do think that it is important, and it is an important part of what's been alleged here. And what the question has been is, what is the element of a fraudulent conveyance? What evidence was put forth here? And I know that Your Honor asked about the evidence here. And what's important, and what is clear from Judge Castillo's opinion, is that Judge Castillo said that Judson Atkinson pointed to one fact, and this is critical, that there was testimony that there was cash flow problems. Now, what you heard from Judson Atkinson's counsel was, while the records replete with all of these issues, promissory notes and things like that, that was not pointed out to Judge Castillo. Judge Castillo's job is not to do the work for the plaintiff. The plaintiff was supposed to put forth and point to the record where it believed it had evidence to support the cause of action that it was asserting in this case. And it only pointed to incomplete testimony that said that there were cash flow problems. The second thing that's also been raised, again, if you look carefully at the briefs and what was said below, there's a lot of assertions, but look at the facts and what has been pointed to. What has been argued to your honors is the following. We found evidence of transfers. These transfers benefited certain parties. But when you look at what was given to the judge, was a list of payments with no explanation labeled fraudulent conveyances. Those were payments that were from the parent corporation. They didn't involve LMC, which is where they're trying to assert that there were fraudulent conveyances. These are payments by the parent corporation. Now, again, the argument that was being made was that somehow, well, the parent corporation did not derive any revenues of its own. But it's also clear in the record that there were other subsidiaries from which the parent corporation received funds, and also there were substantial funds that were put into the parent corporation by the primary shareholder, Mr. Barry Carroll, as well as Laurel Trust. So if you think about the Celotex decision, which is a case which says we're not going to allow plaintiffs to just simply move forward with their case and get before a jury unless they can show an essential element of their case, that's exactly what we have here. There's a complete failure here to make out any claim, any shred of evidence, that one dime in LMC went upstream to CIC and its sole share, well, not sole share, but one of its shareholders, Mr. Barry Carroll, or any other party. In fact, to the contrary, to the very contrary, what is in the record is that millions of dollars went from CIC down to LMC, and in the years immediately prior to the cessation of business by LMC, more than $1.5 million went from LMC, or went from CIC, the parent, to LMC, from the parent to the subsidiary. And the asset sales, which are, again, part of this amorphous, vague, ambiguous, fraudulent conveyance scheme that they're raising, which involves the sale of assets to a company called Latini Holberger DeMontech, one of the defendants, those sales, it's absolutely crystal clear that the money was used to pay creditors of LMC. And if you read Judge Castillo's opinion, he specifically takes them to task on the argument that they pointed to a memo that claimed that money went to pay CIC's creditors, that's the parent corporation. And Judge Castillo caught him and said, no, let's look at that memorandum. That memorandum says the money is going to the creditors of LMC. So there's a complete misrepresentation or misstatement. I don't want to go too far, but a misstatement of what exactly happened. And there's a complete absence of proof. Now, with respect to the piercing issue, again, there are two elements in Illinois. There's really very little argument of what the law is. And the argument is that there must be some unity of interest between the party that is sought to be held responsible, the parent corporation, and the subsidiary in such a manner that you can't distinguish the two. And then the second issue is that there has to be some sort of gross unfairness or some sort of unfairness in with respect to the corporate form. Now, there are a lot of issues, and I don't think we have quite enough time to go through all the issues, but I do want to address one particular issue that has been raised, and that is the claim that LMC was somehow inadequately capitalized. And this, to me, is the most mind-boggling argument because LMC had done business for 70 years as a candy-making machine company, had sold products to Judson Atkinson for many, many years, and the only evidence pointed by Judson Atkinson to inadequate capitalization is that the company was losing money. And Your Honor knows as well as I do that every single corporation that files bankruptcy on the Seventh Circuit or on the seventh floor of this building would lose the corporate shield if that were the test. Losing money is not the same as inadequate capitalization.
It's possible to be a debtor in bankruptcy even if you are making money.
It's true. Now, the other thing that is also very important is that the second part, which is that there has to be some sort of gross unfairness, and the courts really do struggle with what exactly that means, but it really, at least from the way I read the cases, and I think it's the Fontana case, says that there has to be some sort of fraud or deception. And you can tell that if there was some expectation by Judson Atkinson that any of these parties were somehow responsible for its debt, it would have sued them in the very first case when it sued LMC. It only sued them after the fact. Now, I'd like to address one last point on the cause of action, and that's the breach of fiduciary duty claim. And this is a rather unfortunate issue that's crept into the law, the question of whether creditors have independent cause of action for breach of fiduciary duty claims when the company's in the so-called zone of insolvency. And the fact of the matter is that I think the Jiwala case in the Supreme Court of Delaware has, I think, clarified the law now that if a corporation is in the zone of insolvency, it does not give individual cause of action to individual creditors. The officers and directors have always had and will always have fiduciary duties to the corporation. That does not give an individual creditor the right to sue on its own behalf for its own benefit. Now, the very last issue which was brought up is the question about the sanctions. And again, what was stated to your honors is very different from the facts. What was pointed out was the following statement, that somehow the defendants provided the information to Judson Atkinson prior, and therefore there's no harm. You know, no harm, no foul. What they don't tell you is the documents that they're referring to are documents from the prior lawsuit, which was in Texas, which was represented by a different set of lawyers. So what they're failing to indicate to the court is that they want to make out the argument, well, wait a second, you know, they gave us the documents, we only subpoenaed documents and only received documents that we already had. The true reality is that those documents were unknown to the lawyers in this case. So there truly was an element of unfairness. And the other thing, too, if you read their briefs carefully, is that they say, well, wait a second, we received some of the documents, the third group, after the discovery cutoff. What they don't tell you, but what's very implicit in that statement, is that the first and the second batches were received a month before, well before the discovery cutoff period, and well before they had an obligation to turn those over to the defendants in this case. And they held that back, and that's what upset Judge Castillo. This is not an element of unfairness, and this was not an element where they could cure this by offering to provide a stipulation to some of the defendants and not all the defendants. This truly is something where the judge had every right to impose sanctions. This is truly beyond the bounds.
I'd like to ask a question. One of the claims here is that there was summary judgment sua sponte in favor of Demantic, even though they hadn't moved for it, apparently. And I guess the purported answer to that is that there was a claim made in the opposite direction. Is that correct? For fraudulent transfer. Is that right? I gather that the theory of Demantic being liable with successor liability. Is that correct that the claim was made? Of course, there are all kinds of theories of successor liability. How do you say that they were on notice of what all those theories might be?
Sure. I'll be happy to. And it certainly is the issue that they let off with, thinking, I believe that they thought that was their they're ace in the hole. There's a little bit more to this, as there is with everything in this appeal. The fact of the matter is that there was not a successor liability claim. There's a fraudulent conveyance claim. Again, an ambiguous fraudulent conveyance claim saying that all these parties were part of some fraud. The fact is that because Judge Castillo found that there was no fraudulent conveyance, it by definition means that any alleged participant cannot be liable. So there is an element of res judicata. You cannot send this back. If you find that there's no fraudulent conveyance, if you uphold Judge Castillo's decision on that point, then sending this back to try to have a trial on whether a party who's an alleged participant of something that's found not to be fraudulent would be a waste of time. It's res judicata. So the court properly found that there was no fraudulent conveyance, and that means by definition that any alleged participant is not part of it. Now, I'd like to also address to Your Honor something that is a little bit related to this. Again, this is the claim that LMC was defaulted. And just to tie all the ends here, LMC was sued again for the same amount. And they have a judgment from Texas. It's a default judgment, and no one's claiming that that judgment against LMC in the Texas case is somehow impacted by the fact that there's not a second judgment here. But this plaintiff and this appellant doesn't need two judgments on the same amount. It has one. And the fact that there's been a second there's been a reluctance to grant yet another judgment does in no way impacts or harms or in any way prejudices the plaintiff. Thank you very much, Ren. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Del Nero. Anything further, Mr. Iskett?
Just briefly, Your Honors, with respect, I'm going to touch base on a rebuttal basis. With respect to the production of the documents from prior counsel, Mr. Del Nero neglected to tell the court that the documents in issue had been produced by one Dave Ellis, who was the prior attorney for Carroll International Corporation in this litigation, not the prior litigation. The other thing I want to talk about is the fraudulent transfers. Mr. Del Nero tells us that the monies from the sale of the assets of LMC went to pay its creditors. Evidence before Judge Castillo and evidence in this submitted with the support of the briefs show that after the assets were sold by LMC, all of the sale proceeds went into the account of Carroll International. Then they show that transfers were made almost immediately to another bank account, LaSalle Bank, not a bank account of LMC. Transfers also were made to the defendant, Barry Carroll, immediately, in an amount approximating $100,000. Taxes were paid for another entity called Wildwood LLC, another entity of Barry Carroll, all from the assets. And finally, the funds that were in a certificate of deposit belonging to LMC, securing an LMC loan, was deposited into Carroll International's account. It could hardly be argued that those funds went to the creditors of LMC. We talked in the brief, and just want to touch briefly on the six badges of fraud. The evidence in this case shows, undisputed, transfers to insiders. They were concealed. Before the transfers were made, the lawsuit was threatened, was known by all of the recipients of the transfers. The transfers consisted of substantially all of the assets. LMC was insolvent, and the transfers occurred shortly before or immediately after the liability occurred. Six of the 11 badges of fraud were met. The Sealand case, which Mr. Del Nero talked about obliquely regarding the elements of alter ego, veil piercing, and the promotion of injustice as something that tags along with the unity of interest. In answer to your question about the Texas law, it was significant at the time. It subsequently became insignificant. Texas has a theory of single business enterprise, which makes the burden on plaintiffs in a fraudulent transfer case somewhat lessened as opposed to the burden imposed under normal transfers. Since the evidence reflected that the fraudulent transfers had occurred, the single business, and that there was just an overt commingling of assets, the single business enterprise theory did go by the wayside. The district court failed to consider summary judgment evidence. The summary judgment resulted from weighing the evidence and determining the credibility of the witness. For that reason, we ask that it be reversed, and I thank you for the opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until next week.